Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
What's up, everybody? Welcome to another episode of Game Dev Unchained, the number one game development podcast about game development and the lifestyle thereof. I am your host, Brandon Pham, and with me, an old friend, Jay Powell.
Hey, Brandon. It's good to be back, man.
All right, man. This is the part of the podcast where I ask our guest, which is yourself, a little bit about yourself, where you've been, where you're at, where you're heading, before we get into it.
So, where I've been... 25 years on the business side of games. So a bit of a background. I started out as an agent, did some of the very first publishing deals for Paradox and Haimont, the People Can Fly, Starbreeze, did that for a little while. Then we transitioned that into a casual game publisher, which I ran the acquisitions and built the distribution network for. Did that for about three more years and left to start a what we would now call a production firm, but a production studio. But back then, no one knew what that was. So developers thought we were publishers and publishers thought we were developers. And we were truthfully just in the middle coordinating everything. Did that for 3 years and then I founded the Powell Group. And so there's two sides of my world now. One is the Powell Group consulting side, which, you know, we do everything from helping developers find publishers to scouting games for publishers and investors and doing audits on projects. Basically, if it revolves around the business side of the industry, we do something with it. But then my pride and joy is indie game business, which we started probably 5 years ago at this point. Just had years of frustration with no one teaching developers how to do business and finally just said, okay, never mind, I'll do it myself. And with the help of Dan, aka Indy, on Twitch, we started a small little Twitch channel that every week we sat down and did interviews or sessions or Q&As talking about the business, the marketing, the licensing side of things. And then that grew into a big Discord channel. We've got like close to 6,000 industry professionals in that now. And we turned the Twitch channel into a podcast, which made everything even bigger. And so now we stream every week on YouTube, Twitch, LinkedIn, and Facebook, plus it's live on our Discord. But the big thing is, every single session we've ever done, every conference session, every podcast, you know, with experts in the industry, it's all 100% free. We don't lock anything behind a vault or something like that. You just go to our YouTube page. And if you want to learn about business, marketing, licensing, how to build a pitch deck, all of that stuff is right there. And it's free. And then we also started like early 2019. We started doing digital conferences before anyone really knew what that was. And coming up, we've got our 15th one on the way. So it's been busy, basically.
Well, it definitely sounds busy. I think, you know, having the foresight that you had back then, where conferences were mostly a physical affair and then they're turning it digital and the pandemic kind of really accelerated that. People are more used to getting information quicker, having kind of like a thirst for knowledge being the only ticket necessary to get in. And, you know, it's great to kind of hear the success that you guys are having. What have been like the main conversation pieces, you know, just kind of being the 15th conference that you guys are throwing together, what has kind of been the recurring theme or at least trending theme that a lot of these speakers are wanting to talk about?
no matter how many times we do this topic, at the end of every conference, somebody asks us to do it again. And that's the quintessential how to find a publisher conference, you know, talk or session or anything around that never gets old. I mean, that's, you know, we've constantly got new publishers coming into the mix, new genres and business models popping up. But every single time we do a conference, there is going to be a session entitled How to Find a Publisher. So a lot of what we do, especially on the education side like that, has, I'm not going to say gone completely in that direction, but we do lean in that direction. Like every Thursday on the Discord, we do live pitch reviews with, we bring in, you know, scouts and folks that work in the industry, and developers can share their pitch deck or even just hang out and watch somebody else's pitch deck. And we go through it live and say, okay, look, this is good. This is where you need some work. You should add a slide that has this in it. All of that sort of stuff, you know, with the growth of digital in the pandemic and afterwards, it's, you know, the gates have been opened, so to speak. And there's so many more games being pitched to publishers. We have mid-tier publishers that are seeing 3,000 pitches a year come in. So it's gotten very, very competitive. And so developers are always interested in finding out how they can make sure that they have everything or get a little bit of an edge. A couple of weeks ago, we had Joshua Garrity, who's the head scout over at Secret Mode, on, and we just did a Q&A one Friday afternoon on what publishers are looking for. Our podcast generally runs an hour. That one ran an hour and 45 minutes because we had so many questions coming in from developers. So I would say if there's one thing that stays constant, that is absolutely it.
Right. Well, so instead of, so these conferences, are you running it like every quarter, it seems, or?
At least three a year. We did four a year, like during lockdown. And then last year, I think we used to do them, or for a while we did them in March, June, September, and December. And when June came around last year, that was right about the time everybody was so excited. It's like, you know, people go back to GDC and the live events were starting back up again. And we could just tell that there wasn't going to be a lot of activity if we held a June event. And so we bumped it to September. And it was really a reaffirming process because the minute we announced, it's like, hey, look, we're not canceling anything. We're just moving this June event to September because right now everybody is so excited to be back out in the real world. Everybody's going to these things. Everybody's going to these live events. And I got so many emails from all around the world, developers saying, please don't stop doing these. You know, these are our only opportunities to meet with publishers. And that's truthfully the reason we started doing them, you know, years ago, because GDC is expensive. I mean, you're looking at, if you're going to be out there for a week with one or two people, it's $10,000 spend. Gamescom is a little more affordable, but it's still expensive. You have so many studios all around the world, Southeast Asia, South America, I mean, even North America, Western Europe. Now we're seeing a lot of growth come out of Africa, the Middle East. They can't afford to spend 10 grand and fly out halfway around the world for these meetings. And so opening this digital space and allowing, you know, them to have that same opportunity to meet with publishers and investors and marketing firms and, you know, all the folks that are generally at the big conferences, there's a gigantic need for that. And so we haven't stopped. I told them even then, I'll say, don't worry, that we're going to continue to do this. We're just bumping it a little bit until everybody gets over the excitement of being able to get on an airplane again. But yeah, I mean, that's the big thing. We do it to make sure everybody, you know, out there has a good chance of being successful.
Are have the needs and the challenges of getting a publisher? Well, what has changed or remained the same? Is just people having these game ideas that they want financed, support? what stages are you seeing the successes that, you know, these relationships are going after a conversation? Are usually publishers needing to see like a pitch video or halfway through development? What are the, like, the recurring theme that you're seeing, like, you know, to be safe, this is where you should be before you even talk to a publisher?
The days of selling a paper pitch, unless you are an extremely successful team already, are pretty much over. Even, you know, teams that have shipped titles before, they need to produce a prototype or a vertical slice or a demo or something playable. There's no like sweet spot in there. Just, there needs to be something tangible that the publishers and investors can see before they're going to sign off on anything. That, and it takes longer now to do publishing deals in some cases than it used to. Prior to the pandemic, for the first 20 years of my career, we could almost bank, no matter what changed in the industry, you were looking at about a 3-month process from the time you sent the information to the publisher to the time the contract was signed. Now that is closer to 4 months, if not a little more than 4 months, depending on who it is. And part of that is because there is so much stuff for the publishers to go to. When we do scouting for these publishers and investors, it's not because they aren't seeing enough games. Nearly every time someone comes to us, it's because they're seeing too much and they need help, you know, weeding out and cutting through a lot of it, or going out and finding very specific types of games that they want to look at. There's still far more publisher opportunities out there than a lot of developers realize. It's dropped a little bit. We do the publisher list every single year. Shameless plug, go to our website. It's right there. Download it. It's free. Nothing to it. Originally, we did that. It was like 700 publishers several years ago. It's down to about 550 now. So we're seeing publishers come and go, but generally the fluctuation is on the mobile side more than the PC console side. So there's still a lot more options out there than a lot of developers realize. You do now have to have a demo before you can realistically get a deal. But aside from that, it's still a lot of the same. There's no sweet spot on financials. I mean, there are companies that are looking to spend less than $50,000. There are publishers out there who won't spend less than $10 million. So no matter what budget range you're in, there is a publisher fit for you. That part hasn't really changed. There's still a ton of options. But the biggest thing is that you pretty much have to have a demo or something showable that the publishers and investors can play now before they'll sign off on funding deals.
With so many options, so many tools available, the idea of making games feels easier, right? But, you know, with that comes with a lot of choices, a lot of, you know, analysis paralysis, right? I have this theory that I feel like, even though these technically it's easier to make games, in a way, it feels like it's actually harder as well because of, you know, the competition. But also, I also feel like the ideas are not as, I don't know, fleshed out because of how easy it is to just jump right in and do something. So it feels kind of like a sea of averages.
I would say, yes, in many ways, it is easier to make a game now. I mean, you've got things that the tool sets in Unity and Unreal have, you know, progressed so far. You know, you can literally go in and get things off the asset store and mock up at a complete demo. But that makes it's that much harder to make something that's good. It's like, you know, the big question everybody's asking now is like, well, can I make a complete game with AI? I'm sure you can. It's not going to be good and you're not going to get a publisher for it, but can you do it? Yes. You know, can a solo developer on their own make a game today? Yes, they can. Is it going to be good enough to get published? Most likely not. you know? And so that's part of a lot of the mediocrity and a lot of the stuff that we see, you know, coming through, you know, both our own scouting stuff and from publishers and at conferences as well. It's more important than ever for developers to understand how their game is different. You know, we used to use the phrase unique selling point, but it is extremely difficult to come up with a truly unique selling point these days. But, you know, have that thing that sets you apart from everybody else. Because yes, it is, in many ways, it is easier to make a game these days, but that doesn't mean it's going to be good.
If you're an athlete, you know the greatest motivator of all is the fear of letting your teammates down. After all, a team is only as good as its weakest link. So you owe it to those wearing the same jersey as you to be your best every time you step on the field. That's why there's no vape in team. When you vape, you can expose your lungs to toxic chemicals that can damage your lungs. If you're a step behind, the team's a step behind. Brought to you by The Real Cost and the FDA.
Yeah, this I always kind of relate it back to music. I'm not a musician. I barely sing. But I'm just saying, like, it in theory, I feel like everyone can just put together technically a song, right? But very few can be popular. Very few can make it through the market. Very few artists actually make it to the top. I feel like in this period of game making, we're hitting similar barriers of entry, right? The barriers of entry are lower than ever, right? But like you said, to make something actually good has gotten a lot tougher. And it all draws from the experiences of the developer, which is each to their own, very unique, but very few are actual... They're actually trying to say something, if that makes sense. Because yeah, I mean, there is a lot of crap out there right now.
There is. But that's part of that is also building on iteration, you know? And one thing I tell investors all the time is, yes, you can turn around and predict what the stock market's going to do for Activision or EA or Ubisoft or, you know, one of the big AAA studios or companies. But those companies aren't innovative. They're not ever going to be innovative. They have an objective to their shareholders to make money. And so whenever it comes down to true innovation in the industry, that's where indie developers and indie games come in, because they're the ones going out there and taking the risk on stuff. If you look at almost every major genre that has evolved in the last 5-10 years, it has come and been born of some sort of indie game, you know, somebody who was doing something different that wasn't like everybody else. And because their only objective was to keep themselves happy and make sure they had enough money coming in for them and not like an entire board of shareholders and all this other stuff, they were able to do that. And so I think the phrase that we're looking for is the barrier of entry is lower, but the barrier of success is much higher. But the way that you do that isn't by doing another Metroidvania that doesn't really separate itself from Hollow Knight or Celeste or something like that. It's doing something that very few people, if anyone, has done before, or doing it in a, you know, more unique way or with a different feel to it, that sort of stuff. That innovation is what makes the indie team stand out from everybody else. And that's what publishers look for.
Right. Yeah. There's definitely, the finding a voice, finding a reason for why your game is being made is going to be a difficult one. I foresee the next 5-10 years with, there is like this quantity problem that we're having. You know, there's so many, I was just talking about this, with the previous guest, that, you know, with entertainment, you know, being a close cousin, there's so many streaming services now that content is king, but, you know, every two Fridays or every Friday, there's always new stuff, right? So there's so much to watch where I'm constantly finding myself behind on the latest thing. All these services are always looking for content to fill, right? So there is like this quantity thing where a lot of developers can create, right? Average, right? Content, really, because the what you're asking for is average content if you're constantly asking for content to fill up your to update your library, right? But at the same time, we're I think the combative part to that is that there's a lot of remakes. You know, there's a lot of like Resident Evil, there's a lot of Metal Gear, like in this era, that we're taking back because those game designs are pretty solid. Now we're just updating the graphics, and even then it takes 2 to 3 years, right? So it's rare, I think, to see that type of basically PS2 quality game with updated graphics with a new IP nowadays. New IP nowadays to do that on the first try is completely difficult. Like we Striking Distance with Callisto Protocol, it is quad A, right? At the same time, though, Dead Space Remake came out, right? They're ironically, if you guys know the history at all, right? For the listeners and yourself, the Callisto Protocol team were the original dev team that made, you know, Dead mm-hmm. Space. And for them to come out at the same time, it's kind of like you're being haunted by your old work, right? At least for the developer. And from what I read, I haven't played either of them yet. Neither of them. Dead Space was a solid game of the year, right? And they just updated the graphics and people just said Dead Space is completely obliterated the Callisto, you know.
But that gets back to that point.
Yeah.
You know, these studios can look at doing remakes the same reason, same way Hollywood does.
Yeah.
It's easier, and it's, well, I don't want to say easier. It's still a technical challenge, and you're still dealing with, like you said, you know, a year or 2 years of game development. But predicting the sales is easier, and they can sit down and they can say, okay, look, we can spend, you know, $20, $40, $50 million on this new IP, and here's our projection for it, or we can spend that much or maybe even less on remaking an old game, and we're going to see that much more. You know, here's the progression, here's the projections for that, and then a little more. Our industry is getting to the point now, you know, where we have had a solid 30, 40, 50 years of good game development. You see Nintendo does it. They're remastering all the old Zelda games and putting them on Switch. You know, Atari is back in its, what, third iteration doing, you know, remaking games. You're having a lot of these things that were successful on PS2 or, you know, some of the older platforms that are getting redone and re-released. But you got to remember, you know, solid Metal Gear on the PS2 was still a $100 million game, probably. I mean, yeah. At least 50, probably closer to 100 million to get that thing developed. That's still a load of money. And so, yes, the developers, in the case of the Callisto Protocol, they are going up against their old stuff, but it's in the same sense that, you know, a lot of these games in the AAA space are going against each other. It's like, look at how much stuff got readjusted as Baldur's Gate came to launch time, and they ended up moving that up like, what, 2 months maybe? And then Starfield coming out, you know, the AAA publishers knew there were going to be a competitive Q3 and Q4 on sales in that genre. At the same time, you had an indie RPG come out, Sea of Stars, and did, I think, 100, 200,000 units in the first week. So there are still plenty of opportunities out there for good games, but, you know, developers need to make sure that what they're creating is good and it stands out from everything else in some, you know, way, shape, or form. Because I guarantee you, Sea of Stars development budget was a tiny fraction of what, you know, Baldur's Gate 3 or Starfield was. So there's still opportunities You've just got to be much smarter about it. The days of, oh, we're going to make a good game and we're going to put it on Steam and it's going to sell, that shit's dead and gone. That doesn't happen anymore. You've got to be able to think beyond that and get the marketing and everything else going for the game in order to have that success.
Yeah, I think he kind of touched upon it at the beginning where the iteration part of it is king. Like, if you blow everything at the beginning and now can't keep the dev team around to iterate on the fixes, on the feedback, keep the community going, that's usually how, you know, these studios are closing. And I think, you know, the AAA, the bigger games are still kind of going through that cycle of bigger and better. And this is our one shot, our gamble, to see if it kind of hits. It is really foolish to for them to keep doing that, which is very surprising, given how many, all the lessons learned and the avenues we can go about marketing and doing these things. I wonder why exactly. I think it's a lot of what I'm noticing in the industry is, like, with these remakes, with these newer games, with the return to single player games being kind of trending again, there's like a changing of guards, it feels like, to me, right? There's still remnants of like bigger and better AAA experience. I think everybody still kind of want that if they can do it, right? I think there's only a few studios that can almost guarantee their own success. A lot of it's like the Sony studios, to be honest. A lot of the Sony first party publishers somehow are able to handle that formula better than most other publishers. Sony and Nintendo, I would say. Nintendo has it the best.
Nintendo's its own beast. They're going to keep doing what they're doing, and they're going to be successful at it. But it's hard to put them against
their other... budget is nowhere the same as, yeah, like something like Naughty Dog or God of War, right? These budgets have been ballooning to 200 million, to almost 300 now. Like, I think GTA coming out or rumored to be coming out next year is like upwards of $500 million or something at this point.
Well, I mean, the last one, or was it, there was something I read, it was either the last Red Dead or the last GTA, you know, that was a 6-month cycle, $200 million plus. And that was the last version, not this one.
So it's much more. But, yeah, you know, those are the type of developers that can almost... Not to say that they're not putting a lot of work into it, but they have an idea that they can, at least if it's good, most people will. Because GTA itself have been, how many copies have they sold by now? 100 plus million?
That
copies?
And the fact that all the shark cards and the post-launch content DLC stuff, that's, microtransactions have absolutely exploded that game for years. But
exploded,
yeah,
that game, extended that game's shelf life. More impressively than any other game. And that's a single player experience mostly. And then they tagged on the multiplayer, which have something recently they found and stumbled upon, right? At least in their franchise. And all these clones, like Saints Row with Volition kind of closing down, they have outlasted everybody. So now they become the de facto open world GTA experience. For anyone that likes that type of thing, nobody else is competing against them anymore. But again, that's like a very selected few. And a lot of that, I feel the heads of those studios are the same, right? Same types of people that are sticking together. The recreation of those successes have diminished greatly. Like, you don't hear too much of a new developer having the beginnings of a GTA success as much.
Well, you do, but they're not coming out of the gate making a GTA.
Right.
I met with an investor, one of the investment firms that I know. We were at a conference, we were out at a party or dinner or something. And I asked him, I said, what are you actually looking for? When you go and you're looking for a team to invest in, what is it you're really looking for? And he said, it's not as much the game. It's not even as much the team. He said, I want to find that person who's leading a group that came from a successful AAA game. And they just got pissed off and said, I don't like it here. I'm going to do it myself. And they were angry enough to do something new. And so a lot of, you know, the big teams, the up and coming teams come out of bigger teams, but they end up doing something initially that's usually in that triple I, double A stage first, and then they build up from there. And it's not like an overnight thing. I mean, that gets back to the whole, the industry's gotten big enough, you know, 15, 20 years ago when I was doing this, yes, you could have a team walk out and say, hey, I just finished Diablo with Blizzard, and now we're going to do a different kind of action RPG, and you would have big old giant contracts thrown at them with nothing but a paper pitch. The first project that I sold for Starbreeze, there was no playable demo. And this was, again, like 15, 20, 25 years ago. It was nothing but a mirrored cube bouncing down a hallway in real time. And this was like pre the days of Unity and Unreal basically owning the engine space. That, from a technological standpoint at the time, was so groundbreaking that the publisher was like, yes, we'll figure out the game that we're going to stack on this. That's the part of the industry that has fallen by the wayside. And, you know, when you've got these budgets that are ballooning up into the hundreds of millions of dollars, that's why these big publishers can't afford to really change up that formula that much. Because right now what they've got is very, you know, easy to predict. It's like, how much difference, truth difference, was there from gameplay wise between GTA 3, 4, and 5? None. You're still in a giant, the world's got bigger, the locations changed, the stories got longer, but they were still the same game. Am I wrong?
No, I think you're right. I think they just expanded what worked.
Yeah. And that's what, and that's it. It's like, that's why we see Madden come out every single year, FIFA come out every single year. You know, it's expansion of what's working that's safe. You know, you're not going to see a publisher go out and drop $200 million on a game that is completely out of right field. But you will see a publisher come out, you know, on the indie side and drop $20 million on something that's that, because they're willing to take that risk and they're willing to, you know, roll with it a little bit and have that faith that something's going to be different. That's why I always explain to investors and folks outside of the industry, because they're like, oh, you know, did you work on Madden? I'm like, no, I have never worked on a Madden. I have spent 25 years on the indie side of these games. It's like, but when you look at the industry, it's an iceberg. And the stuff you see above the water is your, you know, Sony, Activision, EA, Ubisoft, that. But underneath that, there's this giant, vast world of indie games out there that are making, you know, really good money. One of my favorite examples is Coffee Stain. You know, they started out with Goat Simulator. And the first time my son showed me that, I was like, this is the stupidest thing I have ever seen in my entire life. I was like, they literally just took a physics engine and some Tony Hawk Pro Skater mechanics and dropped goats in it, and they're selling millions of units. But that took that, no big publisher would have jumped on that title. It was just too far out there. But they had huge success with it. And then they went from being developer to, okay, we're going to be self-publishing our titles. Continued to have success. And then they're like, okay, we're going to start publishing other developers' titles. They're leaning out and they're trying to help other developers at that point. And it goes and goes and goes up until they get, you know, bought by Embracer or whoever, you know, whichever one of these super conglomerates ended up buying them. But that's the evolution that we see from the indie side and from the people that are really, really making changes and really, really doing cool stuff, until it gets to the point where, you know, look at how long it took DayZ to turn into PUBG and then Fortnite after that. So really long, winding answer to the part of, you're not going to see the big budget games are still going to continue to come out. There's still going to be a market for them. They're not going to evolve that much. But, you know, a lot of the evolution and a lot of the really, really cool stuff is coming from these teams that leave those AAA studios and go, we want to do something different. Mm.
There's a, I think one of the things that I think would be helpful to understand is, like, for the publisher side, you know, it's equally as difficult for them to kind of like put where the money, I mean, it's their money, right? And there's so much assumptions and trust that has to be established, right, at the very beginning, basically looking at nothing, right? Just empty promises at best, right? Until you give in the years, give in the money to produce something that gives you even more buy-in to continue with the development of whatever said project. Like you said, one high end of the spectrum, right? You have a team that supposedly had prior success, right? They had come with a resume, and I'm still actually pretty surprised that that works, right? Because you know, there's so much that changes when you leave one company to another. You know, you're never doing the same thing, right? You know, managing a business requires you to step in multiple roles for the business to keep running, right? So if you're a lead designer from one place, you're not going to continue to be a lead designer of another place, right? As a co-founder, there's more responsibility, more things that takes your attention from the game itself. And I'm just always impressed that these new teams that migrate to form a new company, and just like you said, this is happening, millions kind of thrown at them with a paper pitch mostly. And I can often tell how my probability of success is measured by what do they do immediately after getting that finance. And a lot of times I see them getting these fancy buildings.
Yes.
You know, getting the highest salary workers ever, right? Having, you know, Hawaiian Tuesdays in the Bahamas. You know what I mean? Like, they're just spending.
Those are the ones that it's easy to say, okay, this is not going to last.
Yeah. But a lot of them, I feel, do fall into that, because millions of money at first is it's super exciting, right? It's like, we made it. Like, a lot of, I think, the poor perception of getting finance is that they equate it to as if they sold the game to that type of success, right? Yeah. So they spend it the same, is what I see a lot in the last couple of years, especially like COVID. I know right now we're in like this like inflation period, right? So a lot of that have kind of ceased and kind of are reversing. But during COVID, anybody with a heartbeat was getting like this insane amount of investment, right?
Well, and I think that's because we were making so much money in this industry. Yeah. It's like COVID, as horrible as it was, and, you know, especially to other industries, not even on the personal level, you know, our industry exploded. I was having conversations with publishers 3 months into lockdown, and they're going, Jay, we've quadrupled sales. And I'm like, what have you done different? Have you changed the marketing? They're like, no, you don't understand. We've done nothing different. It's just there's this many more people buying games. And it absolutely, you know, we had folks from movies and television, especially art animation studios, coming into our industry because obviously movies weren't, television wasn't being made at the time. And they were coming to games. It's like, well, they already knew how to use Unreal because that's what they're using on the TV shows anyway. And, you know, that they were typically more expensive than game dev studios, but, you know, that upped the bar in terms of quality level. But, you know, I have a good friend who works for one of the online, the casual slot machine, mobile gambling, not like the betting on sports ticker stuff, but, you know, just mobile slot machine games, called me one day and he goes, did y'all just get what are those things called? The checks we got from the government to I forget what they were. He goes, did y'all just give them
stimulus? Not stimulus.
Stimulus check. He goes, did y'all just get a stimulus check? And I'm like, I don't know. I haven't looked at my bank account this morning, and I went and checked, you know. And I was like, like on the personal level. It's like, we just got, you know, whatever it was. I was like, why? And he said, well, we understand our market very much, because, you know, mobile games, it's like, mobile games are all a spreadsheet anyway. Yeah. And he said, we just had our, you know, incoming revenue just shot through the roof like Tuesday morning, and we have no idea why. And they weren't based in the U.S. Yeah. And he goes, now I understand. These people got their stimulus checks and they chunked it into games. Mm. And, you know, we had all the success of Animal Crossing, and that spurred this whole new wave of life sim cozy games. We had so many eyes on us because our industry was absolutely printing money, you know, because people didn't have anything else to do, really. Yeah, and so we did see everybody. But now, as an aftershock of that, we've got this whole Embracer debacle where, you know, they went and bought everybody for whatever. I mean, that first GDC back from the pandemic, a friend of mine at Embracer, we were literally having lunch and we were talking about a dev studio. And he goes, I love their work. I was like, I think you own them. And he's like, no. And we had to go on Wikipedia to figure out if that studio was actually owned by Embracer, because Embracer has bought so much stuff that even people at Embracer didn't know who owned what anymore. And now we're seeing all of that, you know, I'm not going to say fall apart, but, you know, studio closings and, you know, everything getting shut down, projects getting canceled left and right. There's a backlash on that coming now, but we still have a very healthy industry, you know, simply because we've got this many more people. People didn't stop playing. The people that didn't play games before the pandemic didn't stop playing games, you know, after the pandemic. They might have less time. They may not be buying as much, but they're still there and they're still playing. So we're in a bit of a morning after phase, for lack of a better word. But there's still a lot of good stuff going on out there. But yeah, even those studios, paper pitches are very, very rare now. Even those big studios that are coming in, you know, even those new studios that are coming from bigger, more established studios, they're still having to show a demo before they get proper funding.
Yeah, I do see that new gamers introduced into the ecosystem, starting with like very easy mobile games, or even Fortnite, really, are digging to this rich history of gaming, and going through from beginner to hardcore. Since, like, there has been, I think, in media and sports, celebrities are more embracing of like, yeah, I play this, I play that, I love this and that. It's like, it's becoming more like how we talk about comics and Marvel movies, right? Mm-hmm. It's becoming, it's the same people, essentially, which is great. And I do agree with you. Yeah, there is, even though we're going through inflation, I think, if anything, right now, at least in this period, there is a cutback from that, you know, insane growth that we were kind of overzealous about, right? I mean, you go on LinkedIn, you see that that hashtag, that little green profile pic, it's becoming kind of like a mark.
It is. And it sucks. Yeah. You know, because, and I'll be blunt, you know, the whole Embracer thing pissed me off, you know.
Which one?
To no end.
Which one? Sorry.
When the CEO went on and then he, at this earnings call, he ranted and raved about not getting this deal, and it just caused all this kerfuffle to come out. I feel very strongly that if you're going to, you know, have growth like that, and you're going to go out and spend your money to buy that many studios, you're now responsible for the people at those studios, for their families. You know, you came in and bought them. Now you're in charge. It's it angers me to no end to see these companies come in and do that and then go, oh, okay, well, we're going to lay everybody off. It's like, you know, that's shitty. Yeah. You know, and I don't believe in it.
Is there any truth? I heard this from an investment friend, and maybe you have more insight to it, just understand the business of it all. Is there like a use it or lose it type of mentality with investment money? That
yeah, there is much so.
Can you explain that a bit more? So every quarter, there's an amount that has to be spent, otherwise it gets retracted from.
Well, the first thing that you have to realize, and even I didn't realize this until a couple of years ago, nobody's playing with their own money.
Yeah.
I don't know who is actually financing all this stuff, but it could be some shadow government for all I know. Yeah. We'll just go ahead and start some conspiracy theories. Investors and VCs are typically playing with the money from other investors and VCs.
Right.
Which are then in turn playing with money from other, and it goes, you know, down this whole rabbit hole. And so even, you know, the normal realization is, okay, I got bought. I have an objective to these people who bought us to actually turn a revenue, turn a profit at sometimes. What you don't realize is those people who bought you are also under an obligation to turn a profit to, you know, some companies and it's to some body, person, other firm, whatever it has. And so it creates this cascading effect. And so, yes, they come in, we'll say a hypothetical venture capital, they have $100 million. They're going to go and spend all of that within a couple of years to, you know, get everything up and going and to invest in games or projects or companies or what have you. But then they've got to start seeing a return. If they don't, then people are starting to get angry down the line. And as long as you're continuing to acquire stuff, that is good. And let me be blunt in that I don't agree with the majority of the way that these things are done. But that's what happens. You know, as long as you're growing, it's fine. The minute you stop growing, then you have a problem. And so it always just comes down to, you know, the firm and how they're going about. And a lot of these firms are putting in a whole hell of a lot more than $100 million in terms of their funding. I mean, we've got governments now that are putting up $10, $20 million funds because they looked around during the pandemic and went, oh my God, maybe we should invest in these games things because people seem to play them a lot. But it's frustrating to me to see that happen. And now to sit around and see folks that I know who run great studios and they're just like getting shut down on, I'm sure there's some kind of calculation going on behind the scenes somewhere, but it seems like a whim. I mean, this industry should be extremely angry that Volition got shut down. And yeah. I will say that point blank. You know, that is a studio that started with Descent.
Yeah.
Descent came out when I was in high school or college. I mean, that is a very long-standing studio who consistently did great things. And now they're gone to clear the balance on some investment spreadsheet somewhere. Yeah. And that's not right. And I know several of these companies, they're not necessarily under the Embracer, but several companies, you know, at Gamescom that I met with who took investment. And one of them was asked, what advice would you give to companies that are looking to be acquired? And the owner said point blank, ask yourself why. Because if you don't need it, don't take it. And because they're seeing the backlash now, once you sell your company, you're not in charge anymore. Somebody wants to shut you down, they can shut you down. You know, you've got publisher Gearbox, great example. You know, one of their publishing directors got let go a couple of weeks ago. They may be sold off to somebody completely different. And it is completely within Embracer's rights to look at them and say, well, you can't publish games anymore. Now you're just a dev house again. You're not in charge. You're not in control of your own destiny anymore. I've had, you know, owners of some of these companies look at me and say, I had to do it over again, I would not have sold.
Yeah.
Because you get purchased because you're doing well.
Yeah.
And the minute you're purchased, you're not in charge anymore. And it doesn't matter if you're doing well. You could be cash positive across the whole board. But if, you know, somebody owns 200 companies and they're told they have to cut 25% of them.
Yeah.
You may or may not make it. It's one of those things that when the VCs, and yes, they do put in a good amount of money that is, you know, needed to establish growth and to create new ideas and new IPs and all sorts of, there is a good to it. But when it's taken to excess is when it gets, so because we scout for several investment firms, but they are investment firms that, you know, we vetted that I trust and that have, you know, they're not brand new to the industry and we're going to save games. They understand what the industry's like and they bring more to the table than just a check, you know, so they're giving insights and they're giving, you know, mentorship and they're helping the studios along. And that's a good investor. You know, is the ones that come in and they're like, hey, we're going to buy your studio for $200 million. Well, I mean, unless you're just looking to retire, you have to be really, really careful before you take that money.
Yeah, I think that message alone is not repeated enough. I think the mentality of getting finance being, to a lot of people, even though they don't really analyze it as that, an end goal, right? It's like, we made it. You know, our company got finance. We can finally do all the things that we've always wanted to do. But quickly finding out, oh wait, we got to get approved for that. Yep. And yep. It is a weird period because there's a lot of new money being pumped in the industry that don't really have as much. How do I say? Ties to the industry itself, whether they don't, mm-hmm. you know, they don't grow up playing games, they don't understand, they don't even respect it, right? It's just like you said, a box, an Excel sheet for them. It's just another thing. And to them, if they need to eliminate, they do. So, you know, that's where the new money kind of being invested in and asking for investment money is a scary period for me. Personally, you know, looking at that route, looking to kind of make something on my own and won't, because to me, it feels like as soon as that happens and the fun of it kind of stops in a way, the fun of making a game, you know, to make decisions and it being an art of iteration, like you said, being the key word, can you really put a limit, you know, to a 2 years, 3 years, you're still trying to figure it out, right? It will.
Well, that is it, Brandon.
Yeah.
The biggest stress. Problem that I see from investors that come into the industry from somewhere else, and they come in from all over the place, is they don't understand how games are made. You know, say, you know, I know a firm that was run by a engineer, like from not a game engineer, like an engineer, building shit engineer, and couldn't understand why the games weren't, you know, they had said, we're going to spend this much money. It's going to take 2 years to make the game. But a year and a half in, they're nowhere close to having a game. And it's not fitting into the, you know, the project management stuff. And they're looking at it. And I'm like, it's because you're not making software to run traffic lights.
Yeah,
you're making a game. You know, with any other kind of software that you're making, you understand what has to be done, what sections have to be completed. And yeah, you can put it in a very nice, fancy project management sheet. With games, you have to find the fun.
Yeah.
That's not necessarily going to fit within a 2 week sprint. You know, that may be something that it takes years to get right. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of folks coming in, like you said, that new money coming in that don't understand that. And they're like, no. The development team said this was the game that was going to be done in 2 years. And it's like, well, yeah, you can get that game done in 2 years, but it might suck
Call of Duty ships every 2 years. And it's a billion.
Yeah. And how much innovation is in that?
Exactly.
I mean, it's one of those things that's where, when we're looking at investment firms on my consulting firm side, I always want to make sure that companies that we're going to work with understand the space. You know, they don't necessarily need to have grown up playing games, but they need to understand how games are made and what separates a good one from a bad one. Because if they don't, the whole relationship's going to get off on the wrong foot because they're not going to have the right expectations. And then I've got this thing put up on the other screen that a minute ago when we were talking about how, you know, everybody's playing games now. It's not that they're playing games with celebrities and things like that. It's that they're okay to talk about it. Because for years, you couldn't really, you know, if you were a gamer, you didn't really, especially if you were a sports celebrity, because that's when it was like, oh my God, what do you mean you're not out practicing football or basketball for hours? You're playing, you know, on the Nintendo. Mm-hmm. They were still playing. One of my favorite pictures is from the San Diego, I guess they were San Antonio Spurs at the time. After they won the 1999 NBA championship, there's a picture of all of them on their private plane. And every single one of them has a laptop out and they're playing StarCraft. Mm-hmm. It's always been there, but now it's okay to talk about it.
Yeah. Yeah. We're definitely, I feel like it's so popular now. Everyone's kind of doing it. Which also means, you know, potentially a lot of more game developers, newer ideas, like in terms of replenishing talent. I feel our industry especially is outpacing a lot of other industries of new blood, new ideas, new people. But I do agree the immaturity is still with the new money, right? Because a lot of the new money is from older people that didn't grow up this way, right? That's how I see it. So I think it's going to be a matter of time where this generation becomes the man with the money, right? Mm-hmm. To finally correct itself. And it'll probably take another decade, I think.
It'll probably take even more than that.
Probably more than that, yeah. But I feel like eventually we'll get there to that point.
It will.
Like, yeah, there's actually gamer investors that understands and respects the art, more patient with it, trusting the process, right?
And to be clear, those companies exist now.
Yes.
I mean, there are plenty of firms out there that do get it, do understand it. They are cultivating and investing, you know, in the right way. There's publishers that are run, you know, the very same way.
Yeah.
It's just, you still also have a lot of the ones that don't.
You got to find
that those. Don't completely get it. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, I think if anything over the last 6 weeks, something that, you know, the industry as a whole should be extremely angry about is that a studio like Volition got closed.
Yeah. It is a big one for sure. It feels like 30 years history. A lot of people from that studio, I think long-termers really finally out of job because of something that changed the last 2 years, right? It's kind of crazy. Well, you know, let's end it on a good note. You know, we hit the hour mark. You know, this is the part where I shut up and hand the mic over to you to kind of promote. This will be, today will be the 26th, right? For those who are listening,
yes.
What can the good people do to kind of find you and learn more things about the industry?
So today's the first day of our 15th conference. You can go, if you still want to grab a ticket, you can go to indiegamebusiness.com or indiegame.business or basically just search Indie Game Business. You'll get put in the right direction. You can do meetings. The tickets to use the meeting system is 60, 70 bucks at this point. Still affordable. But here's my one rule always. If you're a developer, you've got a playable demo and you can't afford a ticket to one of our events, reach out to me directly. I'll hook you up. I'll give you a ticket. Not a problem. I don't mind at all. That's why we do this. But the biggest thing is, even if you can't make it, all of our talks, Q&As, panel sessions, they're all 100% free. And they're all on our YouTube page. So you can tune in right now. And if we're live, it's going on. It'll be this way tomorrow too. But if you miss anything, just go to our YouTube page. It's all there. And it's in handy little playlists as well. Of if you want to learn about how to get published, if you want to learn about marketing, legal aspects of the industry, anything business, IP, marketing related, it's all right there. You don't have to pay a dime for it. These are experts in the industry. It's a wonderful resource that we love for people to know. Obviously, if you, you know, if you want to support the consumer, not the consumer, but the actual side of the company that makes money, that's our consulting firm. And we do a whole lot of stuff for developers and publishers there. But the most important thing right now is really letting people know that, you know, there are ways to learn about this side of the industry that you probably don't know about. And that's, you know, with our YouTube page, with our free online classes, we've got classes on how to do a pitch deck, how to pitch to publishers, what to look for, and how to evaluate publisher contracts and publishers to make sure you're getting the right partner for you. And then you can hop on our Discord. It's just discord.gg/indiegamebusiness. And we've got close to 6,000 people on there now. Everybody from developers just coming out of school, up to executives at some of these publishing companies around the world. You can ask any sort of question you want in there, and you're going to get really, really good answers from really smart people.
Sweet. Well, there you go, people. After listening to this podcast, go over, check out the stream, learn some more. Jay, it's been a pleasure talking to you again. Let's keep in contact. Hey, let's not wait for another COVID to talk to each other again.
I am wholeheartedly in agreement.
All right, man. Thanks, guys. See y'all. Hello, everybody. Brandon here. I want to talk to you today about something very special. We've been on this wild ride together, haven't we? From my early days as a senior employee, feeling a bit lost, all the way to leading multiple studios, transitioning to smaller indie teams and to the mobile industry, and now running my own game studio for the last 6 years. Throughout this time, you've been here listening and learning along with me, sharing this never-ending journey of discovery. This year, I'm kind of on this quest of meeting serial studio founders, discussing acquisitions, or exploring what it takes to grow a studio to over 100 developers. I've always tried to find an exciting topic to delve into, and every year is a little different. The focus is a little different because that's where I am in my career currently, and I want to be able to share what I'm learning with you guys. So I've always been dedicated to asking the tough questions, bringing you insightful answers from industry leaders and experts, and now I want to share with you how I'm applying these answers to my own journey. This is why I'm excited to announce that for just $1.99 per month, you can now subscribe to our exclusive content series. These bonus episodes will give you a deeper look into my personal experiences and how I'm putting into practice what our esteemed guests are preaching. It's more of a personal side of the journey that I hope will show you that we're all in this together and we're all continuously learning. Whether you're a game developer, studio founder, or just a passionate gamer, there's something in it for everyone. By subscribing, not only will you gain access to this exclusive content, but you also be supporting the ongoing production of the regular programming. It helps keeps the lights on and ensures that I can continue bringing you top quality content and insight into the world of game development. The links to subscribe are in the description. Your support means the world to me and helps me keep doing what I love, sharing this journey with you. So show some love, hit that subscribe button, and let's continue this adventure together. Thank you all for your continued support. And as always, stay tuned for more exciting content. Until next time, this is Brandon, signing off.